Coming up on Tech News Weekly, so how is Apple News Plus doing 1 week later? Also, Google's AI ethics board is 1 week old as well, and it's already seen better days. And Brian Cooley from CNET ate an impossible Whopper at Burger King so you don't have to. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 77, recorded Thursday, April 4th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name and build your online brand with Hover. Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk with people making and breaking the biggest tech news stories of the week. I'm Jason Howell. As you can see, set's set up a little bit differently because Megan is gallivanting, as I like to say. I think she's in Los Angeles right now. Large place, large space to gallivant in. So hopefully she's having a good time on her week off. Let's get right to the first story. Apple has high hopes for Apple News, this News Plus, the service it announced at a splashy event last week that promises access to more than 300 magazines and news content for around $9.99 per month. Apple, of course, isn't sharing any numbers on its launch specifically from last week, but a report by Edmund Lee on the New York Times has some insight into its early sales. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Thanks for hopping on with us. So, first of all, what you're hearing some numbers as far as the number of signups, subscribers in these early days of News Plus. If accurate, I don't know. Tell us what those numbers are, and do you think it's going to make Apple happy if they are to be believed?
So I did get some numbers. Within the first 48 hours, they signed up the way it was described to me is way more than 200,000 subscribers within the first 2 days. And 200,000 was an important milestone for them to beat because that was what Texture, which is the app that Apple bought, that Apple News is based on, this new subscription is based on, that was the peak of its subscriber base. You know, this is probably a year ago when they bought it. So they said, you know, within the first 2 days, we surpassed what we bought. And, you know, it's a nice number. It's a high number. But the thing to note is that there's a 30-day free trial. So it doesn't cost you anything to say, yes, sign me up to this, which I did just to check it out. But I've got 30 days free and I could turn it off after 30 days if I wanted to.
But still, no doubt. I mean, if you're talking 48 hours, 200,000 in 48 hours, that sounds, I mean, that's a large number. At the same time, when you consider all the devices that this could be activated on, I mean, we're talking, what, is it a quarter, half billion devices, Apple devices that this could possibly
another maddening thing about Apple is that they don't tell you exactly how many devices these would necessarily be available on. It's open. Apple News is available in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are 1.4 billion active devices around the world, Apple devices around the world. I mean, maybe, you know, a good portion of that's going to be the U.S. and North America. 200,000 is actually a pretty small number relative to the available devices that are out there. But again, it's ultimately about a volume play, right? If you're a newspaper or magazine trying to do a paywall, 200,000 in 2 days is pretty amazing. So if you're part of the service for now, you're thinking, oh, all of a sudden I've got all these new eyeballs on my content. And so it's always been a volume play, not a proportion play. At least in terms of the way Apple's seen it.
Right. And then you mentioned the 1 month free trial, which makes it hard to really understand at a deeper level what, you know, this number actually means in the long run. So many people are so used to, you know, with services online, it's very easy to sign up for that 1 month free trial. I know I've done it and then bail on the very last day. And it's like, hey, I got a month of free content and, you know, am I willing to pay for it? Who the heck knows? I have to imagine I'm not alone as far as that's concerned. Is there any indication out there as far as what, you know, kind of consumer perception of the service is? You know, mere few days into it, into their kind of trial run.
So it really ranges. I mean, there are people who love the new app and love the service and love what they can get for $10 a month. And then there are others who kind of hate the formatting, the structure of it. There are some pretty loyal texture users who don't like the new format. I think so far the most positive reaction have been the ones who are subscribers of the Wall Street Journal, because the journal costs about $37, $38 a month right now for digital access. You can get it for $10 on Apple News, yeah, plus a whole bunch of other magazines that you might want to get. So it's a bargain in that way. You don't get quite everything you get if you were to subscribe directly to the journal, but a good amount of it. And if you're a regular or a casual reader, the Apple News thing might suffice. So it definitely ranges. I agree with you. I think it's easy to do turn it on without having to pay, but I think a lot of people might forget after 30 days that they signed up for it, and all of a sudden they'll see a charge on their credit card, and maybe they just sort of leave it. Maybe they felt like, oh, you know what, it was fine. I like what I got out of it.
Yeah. What is the value proposition on that? Or what are they already subscribed to? And what are they paying for those services now transferred over here? And that ends up being really one of the bigger risks for some of these publishers is, they want probably more valuable than, the consumers who are buying into their service on Apple's platform. They want their own subscriptions to sell. So how are these publishers making sure that they aren't completely cannibalizing their own subscription model?
So no, that's the central question. I don't know that they know how to do that. I think a lot of them are taking sort of a wait and see approach. Let's see how this goes. Maybe it actually helps our subscriptions, or if it hurts our subscriptions, we should probably bail out of it. And they can all exit. I think that every publisher has slightly different terms of how they can exit, but I don't think it's too difficult. And I think for a lot of publishers, they don't have the mechanisms for a paywall, or that there's a cost to it or startup cost to it that they may not be able to get into. So something like having Apple News do it for you, it's built in, it's a great service, it's maintained, it's updated. They don't have to do it. So they're just sharing in the revenue ultimately. And chances are a lot of these publications will see some revenue, maybe not a ton. It's just a way to get it out there. But I think you're asking the right question, which is there's no way to really know until, at least a few months in, see how it might hurt their own subscription efforts. But also, it's up to the publishers to really figure out a way to differentiate it. We talked about the journal earlier. On Apple News, you'll get 3 days worth of journal content, but it doesn't go past that. So if you really want to dig deep into the journal, for example, you would probably subscribe directly to the journal. And same goes with some of the other publications, Condé Nast publications like The New Yorker, which is, I know, a very popular subscription item. You get most things, not every single thing. Again, it's a hard sell, though, right? It's a marketing challenge to sort of explain that nuance to readers if it's hurting their own subscription. So I think it's they're in a tough spot. The magazines are in a tough spot for sure.
Right. And there's, in some ways, some magazines definitely struggling to kind of like keep relevant in the digital age. So you can understand their desire to be involved with Apple's big thing, because Apple is one of those ships that, that rises everyone along with it. At the same time, publishers have totally been burned in the past by working with, media kind of media efforts in Silicon Valley. And this is yet another one of them. And you mentioned in your article that they really do, they are aware of the risk. It's not like those things happen and, oh, hey, Squirrel, let's go work with Apple now and nothing bad could ever possibly happen. So they realize the risk. Why exactly are they willing to jump into this ship again and take these chances, put their a part of their livelihood in the hands of Apple?
I think, Apple, to a lot of media companies, still represents a difference from other Silicon Valley companies. I mean, namely Facebook and Google, I think are seen as sort of, much more hardcore tech, less concerned about sort of the marketing of something, the presentation of something. Apple definitely sort of emphasizes that. The other difference, too, is that as a content app, it's only this content. It's not like this content is competing against user-generated posts like it would happen on Facebook or on YouTube. So I think there is a difference there that as a publisher, you might think, oh, it's a little bit safer. At the same time, again, I think you hit the nail on the head, which is, you're working with Silicon Valley. Is that really a good thing to do, because they've been burned in the past? Ultimately, Apple is a distribution mechanism. It's a pipe. And if they decide to change the terms or like choke it off, all of a sudden, you as a publisher could be in a bad situation. So again, it's not an ideal situation for them. I think they just see it as a marketing play. given the billion plus devices that are out there, if there's a chance to get more eyeballs and maybe promote your brand and maybe get direct subscriptions, I think that's sort of the gamble they're taking.
Yeah, and you also point out in your article, Rupert Murdoch, of course, you know, largely important. He drove the deal that made the Wall Street Journal kind of be, you know, that led to the Wall Street Journal being included
right.
in this. Why is it important to Murdoch to be involved? Is it because he wants to be wherever this next digital wave happens to be? He wants to be at the forefront of that?
So, you know, Murdoch, yeah, he was a driving force in the deal with the Journal, which explains partly why the Journal is part of it, despite the fact that there's a big price differential between what the Journal charges and what Apple charges. You know, Murdoch has experience with Apple. He cut a deal with Apple, you know, with Steve Jobs back in 2011 for an iPad-based newspaper called The Daily. This is different from the New York Times podcast called The Daily, but if you're go back to 2011, you may remember it.
I remember it.
And it was a first big, it was a first big push. It was both to promote the iPad as a new means for reading newspapers and magazines, but it was also a way for traditional players to sort of become digital. It was a very kind of one-to-one kind of thing, right? It's like if you're a magazine newspaper guy, as Rupert is, the iPad is an easy thing to grasp, right? Because first of all, it's a physical thing on top of everything else, and it sort of mimicked you know, how magazines and newspapers look. So it was an easy thing for him to grasp. It didn't work. And I think a lot of it had to do with the content itself, but also because people weren't flocking to their iPads to read newspaper type content. So, you know, I think there's a bit of sort of legacy thinking at play in this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's there's a sign that he's a little bit out of touch with that move, pushing it forward. And I think that's where, you know, that the other reason, though, too, is he really wants the Journal to broaden its coverage to be more of a general news Times or the Washington Post. And I think that's been one of the issues for the Journal, why he wants to do the deal with Apple, because he feels getting on all these devices could get broaden its appeal and speak to not the traditional Journal reader.
So, you know, another aspect of this also is that the Journal has been hiring staff to accommodate all the content that they're creating. However, how they're hiring that staff is very indicative of what they think about the long-term potential of this service, right? Like, they're not hiring full-time employees or, you know, staff like any other full-time employee on their staff. They're hiring contract workers. What does that say as far as how they might feel about News Plus?
Yeah, no, that explains some of the tension that happened actually inside Dow Jones, the parent company that Rupert Murdoch leads, where, as I said, he wants to broaden the coverage of the Journal. Getting on Apple is a way to do that. Hopefully the windfall from this deal will allow the Journal to hire more reporters to cover more general interest news like lifestyle, sports, politics. Other executives at Dow Jones weren't quite so sure that this is the route to go. So what they're doing is they're going to hire 50 more people. The Apple deal will allow them to do that, but they're not going to necessarily be full-time union staff. So it could all very well be contract workers. What that means is, you know, you could hire someone in a contract worker status, but by the terms of the union, they can't be in that job for more than 12 months. So at that point, either you cut the job off or you turn them into full-time union staff. So it's sort of like a compromise solution where you can sort of hire these people, invest in the news in this way, which is a good thing. But then if the Apple thing doesn't really work out in a year's time or less, you can just sort of cut these jobs or then fold them into real jobs if it does work. So it is definitely a wait and see approach. So even the Journal, even Rupert Murdoch, for all the enticements that Apple has given them, they're still taking a cautious sort of midway approach here. So we still have to wait to see how that's going to turn out.
Yeah, and we'll wait and see if people are now, you know, ready to consume their news kind of
right.
Written content on their iPads the way they wanted to try, Rupert Murdoch wanted to try years ago. So right. Ed Lee with the New York Times, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you hopping on. Where can people follow all your work online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Edmund Lee. And you know, you search me on the New York Times, and I'm usually there most days.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ed, thank you again. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
Sure. Definitely.
All right.
Good to be here.
Have a great day. All right. Coming up, Google's new AI ethics board is already on shaky ground, apparently. But first, this message from our sponsor. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Building your online brand has never been more important, and buying a domain name for your passion is the first and biggest step to building your personal brand online. Keeping your domain name actually separate from hosting then gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. A lot more flexibility there. No one wants to be stuck with a solution that isn't meeting their needs. And who doesn't need a domain name? Everyone has one. Nowadays, it feels like we all do. So it's important that yours stands out. It's not easy to stand out. But Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you stand out. The one that we like lately, of course, .me, TLD. .me is a unique extension. If you've got a portfolio that you want to showcase who you are, what you do, maybe you want put your resume online. If you have a portfolio website ready to launch, get the .me extension. It's perfect for that. Hover offers the best-in-class customer support team and no upsells, clean and simple user experience and interface, personalized email that matches your domain to further support your online identity, and the Hover Connect feature allows you to connect your domain name to many website builders, and all it takes is just a few simple clicks. I have a number of domains on Hover. I love it. It's always easy. I love the approach. They make it really easy. The whole process of picking up a domain name, even dealing with customer service if and when you need to, it's all super straightforward and well-designed. So Hover is my favorite. This year, find a domain name for your passion. Visit hover.com/twit. You'll get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And we thank Hover for their support of Tech News Weekly. No doubt about it, artificial intelligence is redefining everything that we thought we knew about modern computing. It's shifted paradigms. It's also been the source of worry for ethicists who fear that this next-gen technology could be abused or even lead to a future filled with unintended consequences that could damage our world and our democracy if left unchecked. Google is only one of many companies spending considerable resources on its development of AI. And just last week, the company announced its launch of an advanced technology external advisory council that could address and consider the many challenges that face this powerful avenue of technology within the company. Joining me to talk about the potential efficacy of this group is Kelsey Piper for Vox. Welcome, Kelsey.
Hey.
It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you here. Thanks for hopping on. So let's start with why an AI ethics group is needed in the first place. How exactly could things go wrong if it's left unchecked in these early stages?
Yeah, so Google has been grappling with the AI ethics questions over the last couple of years in a couple of different domains. So one is they've collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on drone weaponry that uses artificial intelligence for targeting. And that's made some people at Google go, wait a second, do we want to get more efficacious at these drone strikes? Do we want to be using artificial intelligence instead of people for those targeting decisions? And so that's one. Another is how to use this powerful technology and how maybe to stop authoritarian governments from using this powerful technology unwisely. So Google has been criticized for working to develop versions of Google that meet China's censorship standards. And China's currently, of course, in the middle of imprisoning more than 1 million people for membership in a religious and ethnic group that the government is concerned with. So there's the question for American companies of, are we enabling this injustice? Are we just selling to a market that benefits from access to Western technology? So that's a question. Then there's questions of algorithmic bias, which is if you feed an algorithm biased data, then you're going to get biased results. So this didn't happen at Google, but at Amazon, they trialed a tool to use artificial intelligence to determine whether resumes they saw were going to make good software engineers. And the algorithm learned that male names were much likelier to be hired at Amazon than female names. So the algorithm was sort of learning to be sexist, and Amazon took it down when they realized that. So those are all just some problems that we're already having today. And of course, there are other problems that are going to come up as artificial intelligence becomes even more ubiquitous, and some experts warning that it could have pretty drastic unintended effects. But just the problems today are enough to sort of make Google go, we got to get on top of this.
Yeah, and it can get really dire when we really think about, you know, extending it out 10 years down the line, what it could lead to, and the importance of making corrections now for problems that couldn't even crop up for another 5 or 10 years. But at that point, maybe it's too late. So Google creates this advisory board. What did Google say it would actually be responsible for? Like, how deep is it going? How would that interact with Google's own AI initiatives? Is the plan to raise awareness for, you know, broadly, even outside of Google with AI ethics?
So part of the problem Google ran into here is that they were really incredibly vague about what they were looking for from this board. They said that the board would look at the questions that Google is concerned with and guide the responsible development and use of AI in our research and products. But that's, you know, that could mean almost anything. The board has no formal decision power. It can't veto any projects. It's not clear that it would even have the authority to review all of Google's projects, you know, some of which are, of course, secret. So from the start, they really weren't very clear about what it is that this board is supposed to be doing for them.
And then you point out in your piece, and everybody should read at Vox, that while AI ethics boards are, you know, seemingly they're in vogue right now and for good reason, their purpose seems to be more about PR management than actually driving change. How do you get to that realization?
Yeah, so to be clear, there are people at Google who are doing great work on AI ethics questions. But in terms of these AI boards, the people appointed to the board did not, some of them had no previous experience with AI or with tech or with surveillance or sort of any of the questions that are critical here. The board is only going to meet 4 times over the course of 2019, which just isn't really enough time to make substantial progress on important questions here. And there is no real sign that any of these boards, Google's, Microsoft's, Facebook's, have actually helped drive the ethics conversation forward in the way that, for example, many individual Google researchers have done by studying bias and publishing what they do. And the lack of decision power also contributes to this.
And so now here we are, just 1 week later after the advisory board has been, you know, set up and put into place, and things appear to be kind of falling apart very shortly after. People are dropping out. Other people are very contested for their inclusion, for Google even considering, you know, bringing them in. Talk a little bit about the people behind and why there's so much scrutiny being applied to some of these people that are involved.
Yeah, very much so. So the board had 8 members originally. One has since resigned. There are 2 petitions circulating against other members. One petition is circulating against a member who's the CEO of a drone company, and her inclusion on the board sort of raised a lot of old memories, because Google has been internally divided over drone programs for a long time. And a lot of people were questioning what Google was communicating about where they wanted the ethics board to go by including her. And then the other person who's been contested is Kay Coles James, who is the president of the Heritage Foundation think tank, who has a lot of hackles raised at Google because she's writes negatively about the trans agenda and about trans people trying to change the definition of women. And of course, Google has a lot of trans employees who've objected to signs that the company is like sympathetic to this perspective or considers it an important one to represent in the ethics board. So more than 2,000 Google employees have actually signed a petition calling on Google to remove James from the panel.
So, and then, you know, right now, especially at this moment in time, the last couple of years, technology, big tech specifically, has been under the microscope. A lot of, you know, attention is placed on these companies in ways that maybe so many people haven't been paying attention as closely in the past. So it seems like a big oversight for Google then to kind of overlook some of these, you know, potential optics intrusions, let's say, to maybe put it lightly. Why would Google do that? Do you think that they were kind of rushing to get this in place for a particular reason, or what do you think?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think one thing that's going on is that all of the big tech companies have been caught by surprise a little bit by the increasing skepticism of tech over the last couple of years. It seems like some of them didn't expect that. And Facebook in particular, you often see sort of scrambling to catch up in a PR battle that they clearly didn't expect they were going to need to fight.
Absolutely.
I think Google feels torn between, you know, making their employees happy, who tend to be very skeptical of all these partnerships with conservative institutions in DC, and frustrated by yeah, the trans issues, the Heritage Foundation was also criticized for climate denial. These are just not issues that play well with Google's employee base. But Google's torn because, of course, as an international search engine and as one used by almost all Americans, they feel like there's a core constituency here that they also need to appeal to, and that's conservatives. So I think they feel like they're in a little bit of a bind, and they're going to keep on doing these things that frustrate their employees and spark these petitions and spark a lot of criticism, because they feel like the alternative is, you know, criticism from the other side for being too biased towards the left.
The other side, or just the involvement of government regulation that would influence
that too,
the development
yes,
of AI.
Huge.
Yes. So that's a big driving force then as well.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. I think Google would like to demonstrate that they're doing enough for AI policy and ethics on their own, that nobody feels spurred to step in Washington. And I don't know that they're succeeding there, but I think it's probably among their motivations, to be sure.
At this point, with everything going on and the word regulation coming up almost on a daily basis, you know, it might be a little too late to put that cat back in the bag. Do you believe that ethics panels like this can actually affect positive change? And what do you think would need to change in order to make that so?
So I think ethics panels can enact positive change. Ethics panels like this, that's a little harder question. I think they need to meet more often. I think they need to be a bigger commitment. I think they need to have specifically the right to oversee Google projects and make recommendations about how a project should be modified or whether it should continue. And then it should be publicly known whether Google chose to abide by their recommendations. You don't have to give them decision power, but suggestion power, and then transparency about whether you're using their suggestions is sort of the bare minimum for Google to be at all accountable to their own ethics panel. And I think if you're doing less than that, then you mostly have, a PR panel or a panel that's mostly about building ties in Washington and not mostly about figuring out how Google can act ethically in this complicated territory.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Kelsey Piper, I'm so happy that you could join me today. Kelsey writes for Vox. You can follow her work there, vox.com. And where can people follow you online if they want to kind of follow you, on the social media?
I'm also on Twitter at Kelsey Tuok, where I have a discussion of this phenomenon and Google's sort of failed PR moves here and where I think they should go next.
Right on. Kelsey, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, too. You have a great day.
Take care. Earlier this year at the Consumer Electronics Show, Impossible, which is the company responsible for the Impossible Burger, held an event where it introduced people to the next major revision of their meatless burger meat. I love how it's kind of like a technology upgrade, yet it's food. This would be the Impossible Burger 2.0. It really seemed like they'd done the, impossible, creating a convincing food product in look, taste, and texture. I got a facepalm from Burke on that one. Well, now American fast food chain Burger King is bringing the Impossible Burger into the chain's menu, apparently. Brian Cooley from CNET is here to tell us what to expect. You're a brave man, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. How are you?
It's great to see you, man. It's been too long.
I know. It's been a while.
So first things first, when was the last time you actually went into a Burger King before this taste test?
Oh, it's been ages. Probably a couple decades. It's been a long time.
Couple of decades before stepping foot into a Burger King, and then Impossible Burger shows up, and I'm fascinated by this idea of I feel like I can speak for myself personally as far as fast food is concerned, and specifically something like Burger King. When I was a kid, I was all about it. I went to Burger King with my kids a couple of years ago because they were super fascinated by it, and so I was like, fine, I'll take you there one time. It was one of the more disgusting meals I've ever had. So is this the kind of thing that brings people back into fast food that had already written it off? I guess that's what Impossible Burger is hoping for.
It actually doesn't, because what it does is it so closely replicates exactly what you had last time you were there having a regular Whopper. So if you don't like the idea of a Whopper, if you don't like all that stuff, I mean, I was surprised. I guess I'd forgotten how laden fast food burgers are with lettuce and mayo and special sauce and that wet, soggy tomato. Oh, and it goodness. Was, you can kind of see right there. It's kind of a wet mess, right? I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff. Pickles, I left out the pickles. There's a lot going on there. And then you get to the burger right before you get to the basement and the bottom of the bun. So, you know, that's distracting a bit from the patty itself, which is part of the story here. This is different than, let's say, the future, which is going to be some new products that will be plant-based or cellular-grown steak, which is a product that arrives by itself unadorned. I think burgers are a little easier to nail because they are buried in other stuff. But whether that's here nor there, that is an exceedingly good analog, the Impossible Burger, for a beef burger. The story is there's kind of no story here. It's extremely faithful to what you're used to.
Wow, which is saying something. I believe, man, I think we had Russell Hawley from Mobile Nations on a few months ago when he was at CES, and he tried the Impossible Burger 2.0. And I guess I'm fascinated with the Impossible Burger because I've never had it, but I'd like to talk to people who have. But he tried the 2.0, and he said, like, it's so convincing that it could absolutely, for him, replace burger and, you know, replace true burger meat in his diet. So I guess it makes sense that, a place like Burger King would actually attempt to try this out. Now, what exactly makes up the Impossible Burger that's different from some of the other stuff you were just talking about?
Well, you mentioned the 2.0 formula that came out at CES. Mm-hmm. Again, a tech announcement. And I think they're credibly a tech company. It's not just being cute because what they're doing is they're reformulating something. What they're doing is what all great tech companies do. They're taking an existing human appetite or need, literally an appetite, and they're trying to come up with what at least they think is a better way to solve that need that is more technically advanced, more efficient, smarter in many ways. And so what they've done here with the 2.0 formula, as I understand it, is they went from a wheat protein based patty in their 1.0 to a soy protein based patty. So that's a big shift right there. But also with the other sorts of ingredients that go in there, they've also worked hard to make it more amenable to the kind of machine we're looking at there, the grill. That's called a conveyor broiler, I learned, not a grill. And what it does is, yes, grill the patties, but it moves them through at a very high heat, 630 degrees for 2 minutes and 35 seconds. And then at the end, they drop about 6 inches down this little chute. And we've seen this in fast food restaurants if you look in the back and while you're waiting for your order. Yep. And it was one of the hardest things they had to do was to make sure the patty was formulated in a way that it didn't break up as it fell down the chute and as it was put into what they call a hot holding tray, which is where they put cooked patties before your order is actually ready to be made. These are the physical challenges they had to come up and solve with their formulation. They already had nailed, I think, taste and texture. A lot of it was about handleability in a restaurant or mass production food setting.
So these are different. So then in that case, these are different from what some of the people at CES were trying. They might taste the same, but they're more durable.
In a sense, these are different because what they've done here is they have, this is the 2.0 at CES. What they did different for Burger King, though, is they did get the diameter exactly right, as you can see, and they got the thickness exactly right. So they have very little shrinkage on this product. It's not one that gets dramatically smaller like a typical 80-20 ground beef patty. Yeah. It goes in at one diameter and it comes out that diameter. Ditto over the thickness. So they had to get that exactly right and realize that we have to work the cooking process to make sure we know that we're not counting on shrinkage to fit the bun, because one of the biggest things that they heard from Burger King is we cannot have this thing smaller than the bun. We're not changing the bun. A Whopper is a Whopper. So therefore, do not give us a patty. It's going to yield a burger where occasionally the customer is going to come up with a big old mouthful of nothing but bread, lettuce, and mayo. That's not what they're looking for. So one of the keys here was literally the physical engineering of it. The formulation was already going that way as of January.
And so this the story around how these two kind of came to be, it really sounds like much of the work was on Impossible getting their burger to match the equipment that Burger King already had, which makes me wonder, are the actual burger patties being cooked in the same machines as the Impossible burger patties?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. Perhaps they're on a different temperature and time. That sounds unlikely, though. I suspect they had to form this to make sure it's going to go through the same conveyor broiler. I can't see a Burger King restaurant adding another, what has to be a multi-$1,000 machine and another natural gas hookup. So, no, these must be going through the same path. I'm not sure of that, but I suspect they're going the same cooking path and the same build process, as they call it. That's when they get them on the counter and they're pulling ingredients together and they're building the sandwich as a traditional animal patty.
Yeah, and I would imagine that would be the case too. What I think would maybe be a roadblock for some people is that some people would want to get the Impossible Burger because it's not meat, and let's say they're vegetarian. Even though I know that, you know, Impossible's mission isn't necessarily to cater directly to vegetarians, but to replace meat for people who already eat meat. But knowing that they're not using separate, you know, machines, you know, people get very tricky around that. Knowing that, hey, I want this meatless product made in a meatless
very strict
machine.
Vegans are going to perhaps have an issue if they learn that there is this thing being cooked on the same grill as an animal product that's going in around the same time. That's a very small market, to be honest.
That's true.
This is going to be something where I think Burger King is aiming, obviously, for big market. They're not doing this to do something niche. That's not the business they're in. I think what's happened here is they got comfortable over the last year, I think, negotiating and talking with Impossible to say, okay, I think you guys at Impossible have solved more or less for taste and texture. There will always be folks that say, A, if it ain't animal, I'm not eating it. B, I don't like new food. C, I don't like food that has technology. There's all those communities that will just reject this thing out of hand. But I think for a big lobe in the middle of Burger King's market, BK has realized, you know what? This nails taste and texture good enough. Let's now embrace it, and we can apply the three things that we're really good at as a big chain, which is to work on affordability, accessibility, and acceptability. Get the price, even though it's a dollar more right now, but eventually they want to erase that. Get the price where it's accessible. Get the availability. That's what they can do with 7,000 restaurants. And get the acceptability, which is to market the hell out of this thing, to make it mainstream by the sheer force of their brand and their media spending around it. And that is something that they can do that upstart food companies can't.
Yeah, and I mean, before this, I think, at least here in the Bay Area, I would hear from people who went, hey, this restaurant has the Impossible Burger, you know, it'd be very, like, it would be interesting that there were places that had it, and it was kind of a selling point, it was a reason for someone to go there. When you're talking about a fast food chain like Burger King, this is awareness through the roof for the brand, so this is just huge for Impossible.
And it'll hopefully start to move, for these companies that are doing this, start to move these products from being hard to attain to being easy to find. Because right now, you know, Beyond Burgers, which is a competitor, they're pretty commonly found, at least in Bay Area grocery stores, but they also make a sausage that is like, it's a joke. I mean, here in the Bay Area, it's a game trying to find them. They sell out so fast, and their production is not yet caught up with demand, that it is a thing where people talk to their friend, did you find sausage somewhere? Did Whole Foods have them? No, they were sold out. And so this is not good for a product. It's fun at first. It's great buzz. And then it gets real old real fast. And consumers say, enough. I'm not going to play games to find your product. That's where you've got to go mainstream really fast after your hard-to-find buzz period.
Yeah, maybe they need to adopt the Snap Spectacles strategy and just
no
drop
one needs
like
to
a
adopt Snap Spectacles.
I'm sorry, that was a bad idea. That's why I'm not in marketing. But what about competitors? McDonald's doesn't really have anything like this. I know you mentioned in your write up, Carl's Jr. has the Beyond Meat burgers. Yeah. I don't know if you've tried those. These are just all restaurants that I never go to. But what about
Carl's
McDonald's?
Has been Beyond since top of the year in all of their restaurants. It's only 1,100 restaurants, so Burger King is seven times that big, and McDonald's is so much bigger than anybody else. It's not even close. I was looking at some numbers for we pulled this story together. McDonald's does, they've got 14,000 locations. So that is twice as many as Burger King, and they do a whole lot more money, revenue, per location. So this is just a much bigger business when you talk about McDonald's. So far, they have done what's called the McVegan in Finland and Sweden, and I don't think it's been a huge success there. And it's not even trying to be like beef. It is trying to be an alternate patty that very much, as I understand it, I haven't tried it, says vegetable. And they also have something in the UK, which I have tried when I've been over there in their London market, and they've got something called the Vegetable Deluxe, which is quite disgusting.
It's disgusting.
It's this messy. Yeah, it's that thing there. It's these two vegetable. I don't know what these even are. They call them vegetable goujons.
Sticks.
And they're just they're vegetable sticks, and they're full of vegetable, which is fine. Except that's not what the market's looking for when you're trying to nail burgers directly.
Yeah.
So I think McDonald's needs to get off the sticks sometime. I would have to think this year they need to get on stream, because some of their smaller competitors are stealing the buzz and the sort of thought leadership, if I can use that term, around a product that is hitting to a number of bases about environmental, animal, and human health benefits.
Well, I will admit, starting this interview, I thought I was going to end this interview being really hungry, and I think I'm the opposite. And it's lunchtime.
ended on those McDonald things. That's why. If you ended on the impossible or the beyond over at Carl's, I think you might have a little more salivation going on.
Maybe a little bit. I guess at the end of the day, like, I don't know the last time you had a Whopper, but you just had one. You kind of said it's the same as before, just with a replacement beef. Would you go back and get it again, or are you done?
Now, you know what I'm really looking forward to? Yeah, A, is fast food chains having these widely available. I mean, no one has it widely available. Carl's is it. I mean, but Carl's are not that common, right?
Yeah.
Everyone else, White Castle's, 377 locations, and not nationwide. They've got it as well. So this has not yet hit mainstream availability. And for people who want to be flexitarians, which is the main market this is going after, not vegetarian, not vegan, but the flexitarian who opts in and out of meat-based products, that's where you've got to make it easy. People are not going to drive out of their way if they're flexitarian. I would say they are a less mentally rigid, committed crowd than the vegetarian or the vegan. So you got to meet flexitarians where they live, where the vegetarian or the vegan who's really leaning into this will go more out of their way, I think, to find their particular food choices.
You are a think-fluencer, but you are also a taste-fluencer, Brian.
Wow, Cooley. I just got two new upgrades.
Yes, you are duo-fluencered. Brian Cooley with CNET. Brian, it's great to see you again, man. Thank you so much, Jason, for hopping
on with
me.
Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. Maybe we'll get lunch at Burger King someday. All right, Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. Of course, subscribe to the show. That's the most important thing. Go to twit.tv/tnw. There you can find all the links to subscribe, all of our past episodes, everything you need to know, audio, video, it's all there. And you can find links to Twitter, Instagram, all those kind of things for Twit as well as the show there as well. And there's Megan, who will return next week. If you want to tweet at me, wait a minute. So there she is enjoying herself. Here's a photo on Twitter. Feeling cute. Daughter might make me delete later. It looks like she's kind of having some fun. So I hope so. She deserves it. And it looks really warm and I'm jealous. Anyways, Megan, miss you. Have fun. We'll see you next week. If you want to tweet at me, I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. I will not have sunny photos to share with you, at least not until I go to Hawaii at the end of the year. Thanks to our technical director, Alex. Thanks to John for dialing everybody up. Thanks to Burke for scrolling words on the screen. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody. Come on, Burke. Don't leave me hanging. Thank you.